supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. For the past few years, only men have been in Pennsylvania's 18-member congressional delegation. Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarsky reports that after Tuesday's primary election, it's almost guaranteed to change in 2019.
Quite honestly, it feels a little surreal to me today.
I am feeling excited and really energized.
This entire crowd is just the reason I'm here right now.
Madeline Dean, Susan Bozier, Bibiana Borio, and Susan Wild are just half of the women running for Congress in Pennsylvania who advanced to the general election ballot after Tuesday's primary. 8 female congressional candidates is a record for the state, which has only elected 7 women to the U.S. House of Representatives ever. 3 of those women won special elections to fill vacancies left by their husbands. No woman in Pennsylvania has ever been elected to the U.S. Senate or to the governor's office.
Okay, this is more than a little overwhelming.
In the newly drawn 5th Congressional District, comprised mostly of Delaware County, Democrat Mary Gay Scanlon recounted a story from the 2016 election in her victory speech.
A year and a half ago, my daughter and I donned pantsuits to go to the polls and vote for what we hoped would be the first woman president, a celebration we believed was long overdue.
Yes, it is.
And like most of you, we were shocked by the election to our country's highest office of a man who had no record or seeming inclination for public service.
Scanlon, an attorney who leads the pro bono program at a big Philly law firm, beat out a crowded primary field that included 5 other women. Her only experience in public office was on a local school board in the Philly suburbs. In November, she'll face Pearl Kim, a former special victims prosecutor and the only Republican woman congressional candidate on the ballot in the state. Having 2 women go head-to-head in a congressional race is a first for Pennsylvania. And Scanlon says she's thrilled.
Tonight, we've made it possible for this new district for the first time to be represented by a Democrat in Congress and to be represented by a woman in Congress.
To understand why Pennsylvania is one of a handful of states that currently lacks women representatives in Congress, you only have to look at lower-level offices. For instance, women make up less than 20% of lawmakers in the state General Assembly. Dr. Jenny Sweet Cushman, assistant director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics, says this matters. Typically, she says women feel they need to get their feet wet in politics and work their way up before jumping into a congressional race. But not this year.
This year, it seems like many women, not all of them, but many of them said, you know, I can sit around and wait until I have all of these requisite qualifications, or I can say, you know what, I bring a lot of really great things to the table and throw my hat in the ring.
For some women, as Scanlon mentioned, Sweet Cushman says you can draw a direct line between the election of President Donald Trump and their candidacy.
Many of them very explicitly said, you know what, I was engaged in the Women's March and I wanted to catapult that into doing something more, and a candidacy seemed like the best way to do that. Others have been a little bit more subtle, and they say, in response to the Me Too movement, for instance, we need a culture change, and one way to do that is to have more women with seats at the table.
So will having more women at the table in Congress affect policy? Sweet Cushman says yes, that issues like equal pay, family leave, and the cost of childcare are more likely to be pushed as priorities by women. Erie County Executive Kathy Dahlkemper, a Democrat, agrees.
It's not that women are better legislators, but we bring a different voice, we bring a different perspective, and you need those type of different perspectives around the table as you're making decisions.
Dahlkemper was elected to Congress back in 2008. She served one term and was defeated in her re-election bid by Congressman Mike Kelly. This time around, Dahlkemper said she tried to find a candidate to run for her old seat in northwestern PA, but found no woman willing to put her name on the ballot. She's hopeful Tuesday's results might change that going forward.
I think that if women just see those examples, more and more, then more women will say, you know, maybe I can do that too.
Although Sweet Cushman too is hopeful about the future prospects for women candidates, she cautions that the buzz surrounding women running for office is lopsided.
Republican women are underrepresented too, and so that they're being left out of all the energy and enthusiasm around whatever we're calling this movement should be of concern to everybody, because we need women's voices on that side of the aisle as well.
Of the 7 congressional races with women on the ballot, analysts expect 4 of those races to be competitive. Lindsay Lazarski, Keystone Crossroads.
We turn now from Pennsylvania politics to the national stage, where party affiliation is a potent predictor of public response on a variety of issues. Let's take a closer look with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
We'll look at specifics, but in the broadest sense, does this apply to when Gallup asks respondents if the United States is on the right or wrong track?
Oh, it absolutely does. 63% of Republicans right now say that they are satisfied with the way things are going in the U.S. today. Let's look at Democrats, 14%. So there's this huge gulf in that very simple question.
Has that gulf ever been wider between Republicans and Democrats?
We don't think it has. We've looked at a number of indicators, and this, of course, is what we have talked about and others have talked about a lot, political polarization. Another way to look at this is sociologically that politics, your political identity, is now the lens through which you look at most everything in the world. I mean, we've asked questions about how's your family's finances doing these days, and Democrats say not well at all. We can ask about almost anything, and Republicans are more positive than Democrats at this point in time. You go back a couple of years to 2016, and Democrats were more positive. So politics now looks to us to be a more potent lens through which people view the world than it has been at any point that we have in our annals of polling.
More so than gender, geography, age, religion, race?
That's right. Most of the aforementioned variables that you just mentioned, Dave, are correlated in term with political identity. So we can say that right now, in terms of this satisfaction question, men are more satisfied than women, and people in the South are more satisfied than people in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast, where we are, or out on the West Coast. But most of that derives from the fact that people in the South tend to be Republican, and people in the Northeast and out in California tend to be Democrats. And women tend to be Democrats, men tend to be Republicans, at least tilt that way. So politics underneath it all drives most of these demographic differences that you listed just a minute ago.
So with that in mind, what's perceived to be the top problem facing the nation?
Government is the most important problem facing the country, the way the country is governed. But when we isolate Republicans, immigration actually edges out government by 1 point. In other words, Republicans are more likely to mention immigration than any other problem off the top of their mind. When we look at Democrats, they hardly mention immigration at all as a major problem facing the country. But in turn, after Democrats mention government, which is by far Democrats' top problem right now, and when we dive into it, a lot of them are saying the presidency at this point, these are Democrats, right after that is race and racism. And relatively few Republicans mention that as a top problem. So even when we just ask people, stop people on the street figuratively, you know, what's the biggest problem facing our country today? You get different answers depending on whether that person is a Republican or is a Democrat.
I did not hear you mention the issue of gun control.
Down to 3% this month. And I'm glad you asked that question, because we talked about it just a couple of months ago in March when we polled after the tragic shooting at Parkland down in Florida. We had 15% of Americans who spontaneously said guns and gun control was the top problem facing the country, and that was second most important at that point. But like we have seen in previous instances following a tragic shooting, top of mind concern about guns jumps up, but just a couple of months later, here we are in May 2018, it's dropped all the way down to 3%. It's just not top of mind anymore.
So I suppose we must say that it's predictably proximate to a mass shooting event.
That's right. Now, again, I'm talking here about a open-ended question spontaneously where we ask every month, what's the most important problem facing the country? And then we code it. So what I'm saying is that gun control right now in May no longer comes to mind as the top problem for many Americans, or actually for most Americans. That doesn't mean that underlying attitudes, when we say should gun laws be made stricter, those tend to be staying up a little more than they have in the past. So some attitudes tend to be sticking, so to speak, that is wanting more control of guns. But the issue as a top of mind issue has dropped way back down.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. An Iraq War veteran who was told he might never walk again after being injured in an explosion will be taking part in this weekend's Grand Prix bike race in Wilmington. WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports.
His bike tires slipped as Brian Tibbetts made a practice run up the steep cobblestones of Wilmington's Monkey Hill. After a week of rain and a forecast for more storms this weekend, Tibbetts expects the weather will make it an extra challenging race course.
I just don't feel like I'm going to push it as hard and as fast as I can. Just wanted to stay safe.
But even just riding his bike, let alone riding it competitively, is something Tibbetts almost didn't get to do. He was working his way through the Wilmington Police Academy when he was called up to serve in Iraq with the 8th Marine Regiment out of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Just a few months into his 2004 deployment overseas, his Humvee ran over an IED that detonated. He suffered spinal compression fractures and was evacuated to a hospital in Germany.
The doctors, of course, are trying to figure out what's going on. You know, and they're telling, hey, just be prepared. You might not be able to walk or even run again. You know, you're probably looking at a career-ending type of injury. You know, that was really hard to digest.
He saw that prognosis as a challenge he was determined to overcome.
It created a more of a burning desire to get out there and overcome that other barrier, that stigma that people might have when they hear that you might have some kind of injury.
Now Tibbetts has progressed well beyond just walking. He's competed in bike races and triathlons in the region.
Just because you don't succeed at something or if something's very challenging, you know, you just work at it. Just don't give up. It's when you stop trying is when I would consider it as a failure.
His latest challenge is the Wilmington Grand Prix's Monkey Hill Time Trial. The 3.2-mile race against the clock takes professional and amateur races through Wilmington's iconic Brandywine Park along the now swollen Brandywine River. He hopes his journey will inspire others to keep fighting to overcome whatever challenges they may face.
If you're at your rock bottom or not, you can still always rise above that. And it's kind of like what you do from that point in recovering is kind of what really determines what kind of person you are and what you are as far as character and what you can or can't do.
From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Philadelphia figures prominently among the 1,437 cities highlighted by Atlas Obscura, which sheds light on the history and hidden places that make a municipality come alive. Joining me is John Robert Pettit, head of the local chapter of Atlas Obscura. John, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Hey, how are you?
How did you come to this passion?
I mean, I guess it started kind of naturally with an interest in, you know, I grew up in the city, went to school for geography and urban studies and media arts. And so I actually work as a media archivist dealing with Philadelphia's history. So place and experience of place and, you know, storytelling and narrative have kind of always been something kind of in my orbit.
And so with that, describe how Atlas partners with various entities throughout the city to bring to life Philadelphia.
So Atlas Obscura works on, you know, having people experience different places, whether it be a place that they live already or a place that they're traveling to, you know, in a different way, either find something new or find a new angle at approaching some place that they've been already.
You're a lifelong Philadelphian. Mm-hmm. What are some of the hidden surprises that you've encountered in your time?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, you can find a place, like I hadn't made it out to the Wissahickon until I was in early college. And, you know, the Wissahickon's a place where you can still find little statues, you know, Kelpius Cave, which of course has this long mythology. And, you know, when you get a place that's even like, you know, the bar down the street from me, the Khyber, you know, I stop in there and just recently found out that the bar within there is from the Centennial. And here it is, this regular place that you're going to eat dinner, and it has this sort of long history if you kind of dig deeper or think about it a little bit more.
Your website lists some 45 hidden treasures in Philadelphia. Is that a growing list, or does it revolve or evolve over time?
Yeah, so that's part of the Atlas, is it's crowdsourced, and so anyone is welcome to, and I'd encourage any listeners out there to add anything to the list that you think is unique, you know, whether it be a place or a story or anywhere that you think someone, whether they be a Philadelphian or be somebody just visiting here for the first time, would kind of take some equal pleasure in learning about or visiting.
And it seems like there are a series of Thursday evening events.
We're going to be visiting the Conservation Center of Art and Historic Artifacts. And they've had a project going on with Rachel Wetzel, a photo curator, dealing with daguerreotypes, you know, which are the earliest form of photographs in North America. Philly has this long storied history of Robert Cornelius taking, you know, these daguerreotypes here. And it's kind of come full circle, you know, where Philly is now sort of at the fore of doing a lot of conservation work, you know, rounding his stuff up and finding out the best way to work on it. So, you know, it's a really unique project, but this is a way for us to kind of get, you know, really dig down and get to talk to the people doing the work and see the facilities and get into the guts of the project.
These lecture-themed events, are they primarily preaching to the choir in terms of who they attract, or are new and more people coming to the fore as well?
Oh, no. I mean, we, you know, want this to be a mix. We want a lot of the program to be multidisciplinary, you know, taking on history and art and music, agriculture. I mean, food, anything, really. And so, you know, having this platform to put it all out there, I think gives, you know, people an opportunity to, you know, do something entirely different, get outside of their comfort zone.
How does Philadelphia compare with other cities in terms of the treasures that it offers?
Well, yeah, I think given our history, how old we are, I think given, you know, a lot of the diversity the city has, I mean, cities are always in flux. Although we, you know, we have this advantage of having this great history in the city, but of course the city changes the way others do, and so we don't have to just lean solely on that history. There's new artists and musicians coming to town. There's new immigrant populations, new restaurants. We're a large city. We're situated in the Northeast. It's nice and busy. We have this great history. So, I mean, I think the possibilities are endless.
Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Great. Thank you so much, Dave.
John Robert Pettit, head of the local chapter of Atlas Obscura. A theater company in Philadelphia is about to fold, and it's all according to plan. The Orbiter 3 Collective that started 3 years ago was designed to dissolve after 7 productions. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the 7th and last play opens this weekend.
In 2015, 5 playwrights embarked on an experiment to produce their most difficult scripts, the ones that no other theater company would touch, and do it with the best resources they could muster.
The production quality of Orbiter 3's shows has pretty much been possible because none of us really get paid.
That is Maura Kraus, who, as the company's artistic director, worked for free.
You get paid if you're a playwright on a show or if you've contributed other labor that would be paid.
That means directors, stage managers, carpenters, electricians, etc. were paid, but the back-end administrative duties, marketing, development, operations, were handled by unpaid collective members. It's not a sustainable business model, and that's the point. Kraus says they built in their own termination so they could run the company like they were running a race.
So definitely a sprint. Maybe more like a marathon, but we still knew that there was an endpoint.
Over the course of the 3 years, Orbiter 3 picked up 2 more playwrights as members. The 7th and final play is A People by Lauren Feldman. It's a Jewish play with original music by Daniel Pearlstein. As a queer Jewish woman who is on-again, off-again observant, Feldman has conflicts with her heritage.
How do we, as contemporary folks, relate to everything that came before us? What do we do in terms of responsibility, guilt, aspiration, the push-pull, the places where our values are in conflict with the values that shaped the heritage that we have now?
There is no central narrative in A People. Feldman has written a mosaic of short, disjointed stories connected by questions, not characters. It trades in realism in favor of a more fluid tapestry of ideas that jump and bend freely through space and time. Ancestors walk with their descendants.
There's just like lots of impossible, magical moments that happen that enable conversations to transpire that wouldn't ordinarily get to if we're looking at like naturalism or realism.
Feldman wrote this play 10 years ago, and it has never before been produced, mostly because it has a lot of characters and its structure is really complicated and frankly kind of weird. Kraus says that makes it perfect for the Orbiter 3 experiment, which puts playwrights on a high pedestal.
We felt like A People is doing what Orbiter 3 tried to do to some degree, there are all these institutions, these new play institutions that came before us, and we love them and we honor them and we wouldn't be who we are without them. But we want to try something totally different. We want to try something totally new, full of risk, full of lots of work, and see what happens.
After A People closes, Orbiter itself will close. The collective will share all of its notes, its data, its documentation publicly, so other art collectives and theater companies can learn from their successes and mistakes. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.